Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hello, and welcome back to the Spike Podcast for this US election special. We've just had the most extraordinary election, a landslide victory for Donald Trump, something that was not only unexpected against the odds, but also against a great weight of opposition from the establishment. For this, I'm delighted to be joined, as ever, by Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And with us down the line, live from California, Spike columnist Joel Kotkin. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
Tom, this was a really, really thumping victory. It wasn't like in 2016, you know, Trump won the popular vote. He didn't just eke out an electoral college win. No one is in any doubt that this is Trump's country now.
I mean, it is. It's historic. It's seismic. All of the cliches and the superlatives don't really quite do it justice. Because of the fact that, as you say, we have been here before. There was the populist revolt of 2016. But at the same time, there was always that attempt to try to, on the one hand, just kind of dismiss it. This was a fluke that was produced by an undemocratic electoral college. He didn't win the popular vote. That cannot be said of this result, given how emphatic it was. He hasn't just triumphed in the electoral college. He's also won the popular vote. He's also taken the Senate. He seems odds on to take over the House of Representatives. At the time of recording, he's still projected to win in all seven of the key battleground states. And so that excuse, that bit of cope, doesn't work anymore. I think also the nature in which he won, the coalition that he brought together, also repudiates one of the arguments that was used to try to delegitimize the Trump revolt in 2016, which was to suggest that this was basically a death rattle of old, crusty white men who were just furious with diversity, furious with progress, that there was no positive content to it whatsoever. You look at the gains that have been made this time around and have been being made over the last few elections, by the way, amongst Hispanic Americans, reaching over 40% of that demographic at this point. Amongst African Americans, didn't see the rise that was projected by some of the pollsters, but was really significant in certain places like Wisconsin, African-American voters moving over into Trump's column. And I think all of that points to the fact that this wasn't a kind of squeal of white ethnic rage on the part of the electorate. I think the populist revolt, whether you talk about America or anywhere else that we talk about, is predominantly a kind of class-based revolt and one that is anti-establishment, you know, and rebelling not just against the economic policies and neglect of the technocratic class, but also increasingly their cultural domination and their the way in which they've kind of gone off the rails on many of these culture war issues, as well as things like illegal immigration. So it's the significance of not only this victory being so emphatic this time around, but also the fact that you have in America now being led by a politician who's been put there by a populist coalition. You really can't understate the significance of that. And whilst I think as individuals we might have misgivings about Trump the man, as many of his voters do, as well as skepticism about Trumpism and whether it can deliver for those voters, skepticism about some of the genuinely illiberal and reactionary elements which are floating around, some of the intellectuals that have surrounded Trump since then, you cannot get away from how striking, and I think positive it is, that a huge section of the American electorate, who have not been ignored for a very long time, but particularly over the past 8 years, demonized, delegitimized, told to get back in their box effectively, have said no, have put the middle finger up and have said that the issues that they care about, the issues that unite this increasingly quite diverse coalition, which are about people's lot in life as well as their democratic clout, they're insisting those things be put on the table, even if it is via this slightly unconventional politician. And however you feel about the man, it's the movement which is most striking, definitely.
Yeah, because Joel, you know, the establishment to say that they didn't want this to happen would be the understatement of the century. I mean, we've had, you know, two impeachments, numerous court cases, the whole lawfare issue. Trump has been demonized as a fascist, a Nazi, whatever insult you can think. There were two assassination attempts. We don't know by what the reasons for that necessarily are yet. But, you know, again, that's something extraordinary to have overcome. And yet the voters have said, no, we don't agree with this campaign against democracy.
Well, I think that, you know, certainly we found out in the Republican primary that, you know, frankly, I believe if it had not been for lawfare, there's a very good chance that Haley or DeSantis might have made it. And by the way, I think they would have won by even larger margins. And I think that there's an essential sense of fairness, particularly because the Democrats were such imbeciles. The good case they had, which was in Georgia, they screwed up literally, with the prosecutor having an affair with the person she appointed. And I also think that the case where they got the felonies was so bizarre and so stupid, and the judge was so clearly partisan, it just didn't play well with people. People bake in that Donald Trump is a moral reprobate. I don't think anybody who doesn't think that's the case is not paying attention, but they look around and they say, well, you know, what's so much better about the Democrats? What, you know, if I'm going to vote on those issues, maybe I'll be reluctant to vote for Trump. But I think people felt that he had been victimized and how do you make Donald Trump a sympathetic character? It really takes genius. But they did. They made that you felt sorry for him. At some point, it was so insane. And, you know, the thing at the end with the fascism and Hitler is, you know, Fraser and I've talked about, you know, I happen to be a little bit of a student of fascism myself because I studied it when I was at Berkeley and, you know, and particularly on the Mosley in the UK, but, you know, in Italy and Germany as well. And, you know, this is not a fascist movement. There are elements in the Trump coalition that you can point to, but there are elements in the Harris coalition that you could point to that aren't very pleasant either. So I think that fundamentally we really have, I think they overreached and they never confronted the voters. I mean, they basically talked to each other. That seems to be the biggest thing. You know, you'll hear, well, if somebody's a Trump supporter, they can never be my friend. Well, that's really useful. And I think that they couldn't. And then when it went to minorities, as Tom was bringing up, their idea of minorities is some, you know, nonprofit funded by George Soros, you know, and some executive director who got a degree in you know, grievance studies at Tufts and is being paid $400,000 a year. And they're the people who have control over what Hispanics are doing. And the reality is most Hispanics aren't, you know, can't be categorized that way. And by the way, I think that's increasingly true with other groups that were traditionally Democratic, Asians, Jews, certainly Catholics, you know, they're long gone now. And so, I just think that the Democrats never confronted the country they live in. I mean, that's all you could say. They just live on another planet, you know. It's like those science fiction movies with, you know, people living up in the clouds. That's where they are. And that's all they talk to. You know, they are in many ways more akin to the people who owned slaves in the South than they are to the people who oppose them. I mean, they're basically, you know, this is a very, very tight elite. They go to the same schools. They have the same ideas. And they credential their way to success. And increasingly, many of those people, their credentials themselves are rather suspect. But the fact is, they have no connection with the rest of the country. They see, you know, the plumber driving to the house with in his truck with a Trump sticker as, you know, some sort of member of the SA. You know, I mean, that's sort of the way they look at the world, and they have no concept of how the vast majority of Americans, even middle class Americans, live.
And the consequence of that, Tom, as we've seen over the Biden administration, is some quite loopy and insane policies. I mean, it's not just that they ran a bad campaign, that they overreached against Trump or talked down to the voters, but, you know, they have governed by putting woke on steroids, for instance.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the bizarre kind of quirks of the recent period that Joe Biden, who at the last election was very much presented quite successfully as a reassuringly old school, not just alarmingly old kind of character. You know, the fact that you even had kind of anti-woke voices suggesting if you want to strike a blow to wokeness, you should vote for Joe Biden. Day one, he was signing executive orders on racial equity, i.e. woke racial discrimination and gender ideology. And that has certainly contributed to this. I mean, it's not to say that it's the only issue, but certainly a issue. The fact that it seemed like the Trump campaign, if you read the reporting, were staggered how effective that ad with that slogan they put out, Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you. That seemed to be something which really cut through with people. And I think in a sense gets to grips with one of the enduring debates about populism, which is presented as very much a kind of binary discussion. Is this about the economy or is this about culture?
Yeah.
You know, is this about the fact that you've got working class voters who have been neglected by a liberal left, generally speaking, which has become increasingly oligarchical and detached from their interests? Or is this about cultural issues as well as issues of immigration and so on? It's quite clearly both, and it always has been. I mean, I think you see that reflected in Trump's support base, which has always been, its core, the non-college educated, which on the one hand maps on to a degree to working class voters, blue collar voters, but also just people who, you know, regardless if they're a small business person who's actually done quite well in life, hasn't gone through the kind of university process in which people get inculcated into those kind of elite cultural values. And so I think this has been a stunning reminder of that this populist revolt we're seeing is in almost equal parts a working class assertion of its interests via these candidates, a demand that their concerns about whether it's trade or immigration or the economy more broadly, inflation being so key in this particular election, it's demanding to be taken, for those issues to be taken seriously and to be part of the discussion. And on the flip side, it's also a kind of a pushing back against this woke cultural revolution, which has been waged over many decades, but was sent into complete overdrive over the course of the past few years, ironically under a supposedly more old school Biden administration. So I think it's a reminder that the populism thing, the phenomenon, cannot just be so easily boiled down to all these things. One thing that connects it, though, is that it is, as I say, in many respects, a kind of class based movement, but also one that really hits back against an establishment that isn't only neglecting their economic interests, but it's also become so detached from them culturally that you've got politicians like Kamala Harris saying absolutely insane things and not even realizing that most people would hear those things as being categorically insane.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why this first thing that comes to mind, but, you know, transgender surgeries for illegal immigrants in jail as a sort of policy proposal.
I don't understand. Where is your sense of priority?
I know I'm a transphobic bigot and a monster.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
We talked a lot about Trump's flaws, but the candidate the Democrats landed on with Harris, I mean, those are flaws that the rest of us could see from space. And yet it seems as if, I don't know whether they persuaded themselves, were they lying to themselves? A lot of the media and stuff were telling us how brilliant she is and how, you know, what a wonderful, she's run this flawless campaign. She's a great communicator. I mean, I don't think I've ever understood a sentence she's ever said.
Well, I thought your best description was that they came from the Pyongyang School of Journalism. It's first of all, okay, I'm sitting here in Southern California. I've lived in California for 50 years. More than 50 years. And, you know, I have watched California politics, and Kamala Harris is a confection. She was, you know, it's almost like they went into a laboratory and they said, well, we'll have this and we'll have a little bit of that. And then, you know, maybe, you know, for Willie Brown's sake, a little bit of sex appeal of some sort. But, you know, you run a candidate who, you got to remember, this is somebody who's never run against, she ran once against a serious Republican. And her attorney general race. After that, it's nothing. And also she's the product of this establishment. I mean, you know, the Atlantic has always been a little bit elitist from my point of view, but they sometimes did good stuff. In this campaign, they became, you know, part of the Democratic National Committee. And you have Lorraine Jobs, whose best friend is Kamala Harris, and she owns it. And you sit there and you say, can you possibly expect that these people look into reality as it actually exists? I mean, if you live, if you're familiar with Silicon Valley, if you live above 280 in one of those really wealthy communities, Los Altos Hills, places like that, you don't even live remotely close to reality. I mean, even in my little Orange County middle-class community, you know, I can walk into a overwhelmingly working-class neighborhood in about 5 minutes. These people live on a different planet, and they live in a world of private jets. They live in a world of extraordinary vacations. They are a privileged class, very much like the old second estate in France. I mean, and I think unlike, you know, sort of the British aristocracy, they're not willing to put their lives on the line at all. And also that they are fundamentally not great believers in the United States. I mean, it may be hard for Europeans to understand. Most Americans are pretty nationalistic. And we think that this country is an amazing experiment. And, instead, you're running against people who want to turn the country into a bad version of the EU, you know, sort of like, you know, like, the, like, you know, Brussels with crappy food. I mean, I don't see the appeal of that. Why would an American, I would say a Hispanic second generation person who's, you know, an electrician, why would they want to have a society which is regulated like it is in Europe? That, why would you want that? You wouldn't want that. And so, you know, a lot of it is, how do people make a living? If you make your living with your hands, if you make your living in the private sector, you're much more likely to want a more conservative, more of a Donald Trump approach. But if you work for the schools and, you know, the taxpayers are paying for your incredible pensions, you know, why wouldn't you, you know, support Kamala Harris? So the question is, I think the Biden people didn't have time to turn the country into essentially a government economy. You know, I think maybe in the UK, you guys are ahead of us on that. I mean, I remember when I was there recently, you know, people saying to me that, you know, Starmer is the public sector. That's what he represents. And I think that's what Harris ended up representing, the public sector and that part of the corporate elite that lives off the public sector. You know, the nonprofits, the green capitalists, those are the ones who supported Harris. You know, you've got to remember, you know, you're going to start hearing, oh, Trump won because he had Elon Musk and he had, you know, these oligarchs. But as we've written, you know, overwhelming majority of the oligarchs supported Harris. Now, it's interesting that the day after the election, they all bought stock. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
No, and it's the fact that, you know, Harris outraised the Trump campaign, what, by 3-1?
Yeah.
I mean, it was so clear where the big money was lining up behind. But because they have the foil of Elon Musk and the handful of kind of Silicon Valley dissenters who have got very much behind the Trump campaign this time around, they can kind of ignore that. But I suppose the thing about the Democratic establishment was, it was, despite the fact it had become oligarchical in the way you're describing, the way you've written about, Joel, there was always this kind of phony claim to moral authority, which is that we are the party that speaks on behalf of minorities and so on. You know, they'd already kind of quietly junked the fact that they were supposedly the party of the working class, but they just embraced this kind of identitarian script, which is why I think that this revolt against identity politics that you see most pronounced in the Hispanic vote, but present in other sections of the electorate as well, is so incredibly striking and encouraging. And actually speaks to the fact that these kind of cleavages that supposedly exist in society do cut across racial lines. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about the Trump's impressive showing amongst the Arab Americans in Michigan, winning Dearborn, which I think Biden won last time around by about 70% of the vote or something. It's very emphatic.
Which is the first city in America to become Arab majority.
Exactly. And along with Hamtramck, where the Democratic Muslim American mayor actually endorsed Trump in a run-up to this. And what was interesting, obviously a large part of that is fury with Kamala Harris in terms of her position and not a disavowal of supporting Israel. And there's an unfortunate element, as we've seen in the United Kingdom, of that conflict, you know, becoming the stuff of domestic politics in a way that isn't necessarily particularly welcome. But at the same time, it also cut across that. I mean, in the midterms, Dearborn, the Republicans saw quite significant gains there because there was a big controversy in that part of the world over LGBTQ plus materials in schools, for instance, which started to deliver those voters towards the Republican column, even absent the issue of Israel and Gaza. So it's just a striking reminder that that coalition of the ascendant, which was talked about in the wake of Obama's victory in 2008, this idea that this combination of young people, ethnic minorities, and college graduates, broadly defined, we're going to seal in democratic political hegemony forever. That coalition is breaking down in all different directions, including young people, which is something we haven't touched on too much yet.
I mean, there are several things just I have to add to what Tom was saying. One, you have to look at the cultural issues. You know, Hamtramck was a city that also didn't want to fly the gay flag. You know, as my daughter says to her gay friends in college, why are you supporting Hamas, given that you know what would happen to you if you were in Gaza? Of course, they don't know. But I do think that there's a cultural part. When I went to a hearing years ago on how much control parents might have on sexual education in the schools, there was an imam there alongside, you know, the Hispanic and Black evangelical preachers also, you know, opposing that. So you have that element, but also I think, you know, Tom, you got at the end when you mentioned the young people. Already young men are, you know, moving to the right, not only in the US, but around the world. Because what do you expect if you get up and you say, you're a white male, and no matter the fact that your family emigrated here 50 years ago or you came from Mexico, you know, 20 years ago, that you are to blame for racism and you need to be at the bottom of the list for everything. And oh, by the way, and you're going to have to pay for reparations. You know what? When I look at reparations and I say, well, wait a minute. My grandparents didn't get to the United States until about 1900. My grandfathers never met a Black person until they got to New York because, you know, they are not, you know, thick on the ground in the Ukraine. So I think that you know, what you've had is you've alienated people on a professional level, on a cultural level, and then thrown out this, well, you're guilty. You know, now why should a person from Appalachia whose family has been living in poverty for 300 years and never owned slaves, because that part of the South had very little slavery, even in the slave states, and you want them to pay reparations? I mean, I can tell you, when I talk to Hispanic friends in particular, but also others, they say, what is it about reparations? We're supposed to send, you know, $100,000, $200,000 to people, you know, who claim that their great, great, great grandparents were slaves. I don't know. That's sort of, you know, I sort of feel like if you can do that, I think my family should send a bill to the Egyptians for enslaving the Hebrews. I mean, it's like, you know, you know, at some point, you have to move forward. And I think one of the things is, oddly enough, the progressives were really regressive. They were sort of, everything is based on the past. Everything is about balancing out what happened over the last 150 years. Instead of saying, let's build a strong economy so that, you know, you can buy a house or so you can start a business. And they totally missed it. And then Harris does the most absurd thing. He starts talking about giving special loans to Black men to start businesses. I don't know. She's a lawyer. I assume she's read the Constitution. This is kind of not allowed. But so I think that they so missed it. And I think the most significant thing in the long run is going to be the movement of younger people to the right. Nobody would have predicted that. All the predictions were the Z's were going to be like the millennials. But what happened is the millennials, as they grew up, got, as the famous phrase, got mugged by reality. Or maybe the first time they saw that half their income went to taxes. And so what you're seeing is a pushback among young people. I can, one really good little anecdote. I taught a class on the history of the future at Chapman, and one of the, and we had a discussion about race. And several of the kids said to me, when they were in high school, they were told all white people were racist. And the two people who objected the most were kids who were half, they, one was, I think, half Puerto Rican and half British, and the other one was like, half a white American and half Korean. I mean, it was like, and they said, my dad's not a racist. And so the kids came back and they said they resented it. They said they felt for the first time they could actually say, I don't like the idea that in school I was told that anybody who happens to be white is a racist and will always be a racist and will have to pay for their racism forever. So I think there was a groundswell up there, but people weren't really expressing it. And what I would imagine many of those young people will never admit it, but they voted for Trump. Mm.
And Tom, finally, you know, what do you think happens now? Do you think there'll be any reflection on the losing side's part? I mean, or is it just going to be more hysteria, more accusations of fascism? Where do you think it might go?
It's very hard to detect, because in the kind of immediate aftermath, there was a kind of striking lack of some of the quite the same level of hysterical knee-jerk reaction that we saw last time around. Maybe there is this quiet realization that the absurd demonization, the throwing around the fascism slur, that if nothing else, it didn't work. And also, maybe the spell has been broken to a certain extent amongst some people. You're seeing some of the smarter people in the Democratic Party, some of the more, I guess, sort of class conscious elements that still exist just about on the fringes of capital D Democratic politics, starting to talk about some of these issues. But at the same time, there's still plenty of people saying this is America just showing us who it really is, that they need to come to terms with what a dark period this is, which was Kamala Harris's phrase in her speech the other night. So it's certainly going to be it seems like somewhat of a mixed bag. And the question now is there going to be as much of a kind of strident attempt as we saw last time to completely kind of repudiate and delegitimize this vote, or whether or not there will be more of that reflection? I guess the difficulty is that even to the extent there is some capacity for reflection, it's often very limited. You certainly see that in the discussions on the left. They only really want to talk about the narrow economic issues rather than reflecting upon some of the more cultural issues, the question about immigration, which was obviously fundamental to this election in terms of just out of control illegal migration, which people, regardless of how they feel about legal migration, is something that concerns and impacts upon the lives of working class people increasingly across the country, not just in border states. So if it'd be interesting to see if there is some reflection on the left of centre or the left more broadly, which is more substantive than last time. But I think it's worth saying that for a lot of these people, this in a sense is the confirmation of their own fever dream that these are people who've had a very low view of their fellow citizens for a very long time, who've had a very distorted view about what Trumpism, for all its flaws, represents. They have taken it down this hysterical, very dark misrepresentation of what's going on with these voters. I think some of them will probably retreat into the comfort of that analysis. Yeah. But right this moment, it doesn't feel like the hysteria is quite the same pitch that it was in the wake of 2016, but maybe they're just, putting themselves back together before getting engaged again.
Yeah.
Can I inject a couple notes of hope here? Because I think Tom's right. I think that I've been surprised at the reaction. The pearl clutcher is going to clutch pearls. That's what they're going to do, or wet their beds, or whatever they do. But I do think that there is a consciousness among some Democrats that I've watched and some that I've talked to that something has to change. You take a look in here in the state of California, which is now essentially, the Avignon to Trump's Rome. Basically what you have is we just voted overwhelmingly to reverse the lenient sentencing policies, rejected rent control. The radical DAs in Alameda County, which is East Bay of the Bay Area, and in Los Angeles, both taken out by large margins. The crazy radical mayor of Oakland was recalled. So there is a stirring, because this is all happening among Democrats. And there are some figures that I think can lead the party back. And the question is whether or not they'll get a chance to do it. You know, I mean, obviously Fetterman is one. Josh Shapiro is another. I mean, part of the problem the Democrats have is under Schumer, they've behaved like a Stalinist party. Like, you know, Sinema basically got, you know, kicked out. Manchin basically got kicked out. So the question is there a potential Bill Clinton somewhere in the weeds who can turn things around? I feel very strongly about it because, you know, I was involved with the think tank of the Democratic Leadership Council, and there was an attempt. Not everything that we did was right, and I think there are things that you would do differently. But there was this idea that we can't keep doing this. We're going to lose, you know, another Dukakis, another McGovern, and you're going to be in serious trouble. The question really is, are these progressive elites so embedded now that you can't move it? And as has been pointed out to me, the Democrats who are left tend to be further left. They tend to be more progressive. And then the other issue that I think is going to be big is the pushback from the what you might call the socialist wing of the Democratic Party is, yeah, maybe we should move away from the cultural issues and have a more of a class-based policy. The problem there is that's not going to appeal to the progressive funders. So that big problem the Democrats are going to have is they've got a failing moderate electorate. They've got a gentry liberal funding base, and then a increasingly socialist left wing. And how they reconcile those is going to be, fairly entertaining, I guess.
And I suppose another note of optimism is that regardless of, I suppose, what this says about the fate of the Trump administration going forward, what this says about the fate of the Democratic Party and whether it can put itself back together again, the fact that these issues, these fundamental questions of people's lot in life, their political clout, their democratic clout, the fact that that has been put on the table over the course of the past 8 years, the fact that there has been the wherewithal to push back against the demonization and the delegitimization, again, not just of Trump, but of the people who dared to take a chance on him and lob that grenade into the political system. The fact that there is that desire for something else and for a politics in which vast swathes of the country, which were quite explicitly written off for some time, the fact that there is still that appetite after all these years, after many people might have felt exhausted by everything that had come since and might have been tempted to once again kind of check out of politics in a way that a lot of people were previous to the sort of populist era, that desire for change is there. It's there for the shaping and the taking. And I think that's a tremendous positive that you can take away, regardless of how you feel about who has been put in the White House as a consequence of this, and regardless about how you feel about the future of either of these two main parties going forward.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.